2:36 here on the TKO Show with Kara Rowe, and I have a fascinating human joining me this half hour. I'm always amazed when you look at the biography of people and you're just like, you did all of this? You were involved with all of that? It's fascinating. Sharing the inside story of the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, he is the author of Out of Our Heads, The Rolling Stones, The Beatles, and Me. He managed the early U.S. tours of the Rolling Stones with simultaneously dealing with the financial affairs of some of the biggest names in rock and roll history, including the Stones, the Beatles, Neil Sedaka. The list goes on and on. It's fascinating. Joining me to talk about this, Ronnie Schneider. Hey, Ronnie. Good afternoon.
Well, hello. I've never been called a human being before, but...
I'm always amazed. I'm amazed at, like, humans are doing the great things that they're doing. I'm just, and that you're a standout. That is why. This is amazing. The experiences that you've had and the part of history that you have partaken in, it's just really cool. Tell me, Ronnie, take me way back, because a lot of us, even listening, maybe weren't around at that time. I remember my mom talking about the Beatles, and she was like, Kara, I remember women crying and fainting and just the insanity that ensued this hugely successful band. And you were a part of that, which is amazing. Tell me about your start in the rock and roll world.
Well, I was actually an accountant. I started out in accounting, and I was majoring in it at the University of Miami. And I would go up to New York during the summers. That's when I started with Neil Sedaka and Bobby Vinton and all that. And then in the summer of 1965, I went up there to live in New York with, and my uncle Alan Klein had a company called Abco that was managing all the big acts at that time. So I went up to work for him, and that's how I got into rock and roll. One day I was dancing to Satisfaction in Miami, and the next day I was with the Rolling Stones.
And what was that like when you first, they said, okay, well, listen, they need someone to tour with them. That's going to be your job. Was that a big time that when you heard that?
Well, luckily, I'm numb to those things. I don't adore celebrity, so it didn't make a difference. It was just other people, and I looked at it as a job. But the advantage was, when I first met the Stones, we were all the same age, and we had the same sense of humor. I'm a sick guy, so I've got British humor. And the end result was, we got along, and that's how I began working together. And it was crazy. The screaming kids is an understatement. It was nothing like it is now. As it was then. Then it was really all the kids. I mean, the boys wore jackets and ties. So you realize that's how organized and civil everybody was. And then the minute the Stones came on, it all broke apart and everybody went crazy.
Now, you hear the term sex, drugs, and rock and roll, out of the 60s, and you think about that, as you said, all these bands from England coming over and just creating pandemonium. Was that what it was like being on tour? Was it just this nonstop barrage of sex, drugs, and rock and roll?
It was rock and roll mostly, and then there was sex and drugs. The Stones and all the acts that I've ever worked with, the musicians, they really care about their music more than the other stuff. Unfortunately, some musicians think that they need drugs to make them sound better, but the end result is, first thing was their music. Then came the sex and drugs, and that just followed suit.
Now,
but it is all true.
I believe it. I feel like you see movies, you never know how true it is. And then, you think, well, that's just a kind of a part of the lifestyle as well. But like you said, they're artists first, and then you get to play. You work first, you play later, right?
Now, well, yeah, it was, and the tour was 24 hours work, because you'd play a date, then you'd get in a plane, fly to the next day, do sound check, then play another day. So it was just a monotony that went on and on and on, and it was just nonstop, because a lot of traveling and a lot of trying to grab greasy spoon food to eat at night.
Now, in what I've read from your biography as well, you were kind of a part of the financial aspect to the Rolling Stones, where it was not just, here, you're getting paid to play, show up at our arena. It was you were a part of kind of the franchising and reorganizing the financial distribution of all of those different things, whether that be, posters or T-shirts. It seemed like you were an integral part of that.
Well, that started in 69. Before that, there really wasn't any marketing of other accessories at the concerts. You just go and play, and the concerts mainly made their money on selling popcorn. But in 69, they started doing posters and the T-shirts and all that, and I was just there at the inception of it and did some of the new deals for that. Nobody knew it was going to grow to the way it did. it was just like a side thing.
Now, what's one of your favorite memories, would you say, of all times in touring and being with the Stones?
My favorite memory was at the end of one of the tours, Keith Richards said, let's go horseback riding. I've made a deal with the guide who guided John Wayne, and we can go to Scottsdale, Arizona, and go overnight camping and horseback riding. And that was one that I never forgot. That was, you know, Keith said, come on, let's go horseback riding. I think you'd go also.
And what were the personalities like? You said that, you know, kind of the raunchy, maybe English humor. You know, what were they like overall? And were they very different from each other?
Everybody's different, you know, in the sense that you had Mick, who was really concerned with the image of the bag, and he's coming up with the music. You had Keith, who's another story in of itself. Brian, at the time when I first started with Brian was this artistic, creative guy who was very sweet, but he was a guy you could be sitting in a limo going to the next date and say, oh, I want to go see the birds, and you'd stop at a light and he'd jump out of the car and you'd have to pray that he would show up at the concert. And Charlie Watts was always in love with his wife, and while we were all doing things, he would always be in his hotel room calling his wife and on the phone with her, raising giant phone bills.
Yeah, that's.
Bill Wyman was quiet, and Bill Wyman was always quiet, but he was the smartest. He was older than all of us, and he would go shopping for antiques while we were drinking. So.
While you were doing the, you had to live up to the sex, drugs, rock and roll image, right?
Well, they have to live up to it. It just followed you, and you gratefully jumped in.
You gratefully. Now, you know, you have to know some behind the scenes stories that most of us don't know, or it's the opposite of what the media portrayed, you know, at the time, or maybe continues to portray. And you know, I'm looking at some of your material, the Alamont and the Hell's Angels. Now, tell me a little bit about those and the relationship with the Rolling Stones.
Well, the world has, for the most part, has two very important facts wrong about two gigantic groups. With the Stones, there's always that horrible rumor going around, a story that the Stones hired the Hell's Angels as security at Altamont, and a guy got killed by one of the Hell's Angels. The actual story is the Rolling Stones never hired the Hell's Angels for Altamont. The Rolling Stones were in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, recording their album. They got to Altamont the day before the show. I got there 2 days before the show. The entire show was organized by the West Coast, San Francisco, the Grateful Dead, and the ones that usually organize it. That's how the Angels appear at all those shows, because they guarded the generators for the different groups. They did it, you know, you didn't hire them. They just did it because they were there to hang out around the stage. I doubt if anybody could hire the Hell's Angels.
Right.
And then with the Beatles, of course, the classic story that I think everybody's got wrong is Yoko Ono did not break up the Beatles. The Beatles, you know, time, life, and age broke up the Beatles after time and all the other things like other people. But Yoko did not break them up. I used to feel bad when John would stand there and we'd be talking and Yoko would come over with a suggestion and John would just say, shut up. So it wasn't like he was controlled, but I mean, it would be rude, but that was the way, I'm making a point, that's how John was.
Right. And I think that's what happens quite often, right? In the media, what's portrayed in the media versus how these relationships are actually playing out. When we come back, I want to ask you about dealing with the Beatles. What was that like? You know, how did these two groups get so big? Like, why were they the two that rose to the top and that people still talk about today? It's kind of fascinating when you get a chance to see things like that. And we'll talk about your book, Out of Our Heads, The Rolling Stones, The Beatles, and Me. We'll have more when we come back. Once again, we're talking to Ronnie Schneider, the author of Out of Our Heads, and his relationship with the Stones and the Beatles, right next on the TKO Show.